Last time I was talking about one of the most remarkable episodes in the history of international politics. This is the Congress of Vienna, 1814-1815. What's so remarkable about it? It was remarkable because the great powers got together to consciously construct a system. A system based on a certain theory of international politics. And this is the theory that had been developed in the 18th century especially. This is the theory of the balance of power. What was the basic idea there? The great powers were sovereign states. Their main goal was to preserve their independence, their liberty, as people said in those days. Today we would say their security, their ability to kind of conduct their own affairs free of the threat of foreign intervention. Okay. How could you do it? You could do it by constructing a system based on the idea that nobody should become too strong. That every power should be balanced by other powers. Right? Including you yourself. That's one of the kind of remarkable things about this theory. The goal was not to amass as much power as you possibly can, to control as much territory as you possibly can, to reach for hegemony. The goal was to create a stable system, a secure system. Right? Why did you not want to create too much power for yourself? Because it would corrupt you. It would lead you to pursue these ambitious policies that would ultimately lead to catastrophe. You wanted countervailing power to be present so as to keep your own policy in check. Right? The goal was moderation. The whole notion was that policy should be limited. You weren't going to get rid of international politics. These people were not the starry-eyed idealists that thought that you could kind of create a world of perpetual peace where power is no longer a factor. The goal was to create an equilibrium, a balance, right? So that everyone was secure, no one was too strong, no one was too weak. You didn't want to push your adversaries down too low, because that would mean that your allies would then become too strong. I refer to the example of the First World War to kind of push ahead when this kind of thinking had kind of died out. People were not thinking in those terms. Did it make sense for Britain and France during the period of the First World War to want to crush German power totally? Because you crush Germany, then Russia becomes very strong. Russia's your ally now. But don't you need a counterweight to Russian power in Europe? Shouldn't that be supplied by Germany? And similarly, shouldn't Russia serve as a counterweight to German power in Europe? And shouldn't your goal be to kind of a balance between the two? So neither of them becomes too strong, and by that same token, neither of them should become too weak? Now, that's a kind of mentality that did not exist between 1914 and 1918. And the world paid a huge price for that. But that's the philosophy that had come into being in the course of the 18th century and was put into practice in a conscious, deliberate way by the statesmen who met at Vienna at the end of the Napoleonic period. In other words, you have a system here. And this is a system, it's not just something that came into being as a result of all these different countries pursuing their own policies and then observers come along and refer to this as a system. No, this was something that was deliberately created, consciously created. Right? Why is this of such interest for our purposes? It's of interest because some of the most important international relations thinkers of our own day, people like Kenneth Waltz and John Mearsheimer, have said in no uncertain terms that this sort of thing is just impossible. You can't have it. And I read you, some of those passages where they just say, you know, just quite flatly. You know, people are always talking about how you have to, you know, pursue policies directed toward the interests of the system as a whole, you know, toward, what was in the interest of the planet and so on. And they say, it just can't be. And that whole notion is rooted in their whole sense of what international politics is. You know, this is a very dangerous game because you're living in a world where there's not overarching authority that stands above states. States can have no choice but to rely on themselves for their protection. Their margin of security is so thin and so narrow that they can't afford to sacrifice their national interests for the sake of the interests of the system as a whole. That's the basic argument. So you couldn't have anything like that. You couldn't have a system, a state's creating a system which serves the which is not simply based on the pursuit of narrow national interests. A system that is designed to provide for a degree of stability. Right? And yet we saw that this was precisely what these people did. And that raised the whole question. You know, one of the nice things about looking at the historical evidence is that when you come across something that's so totally inconsistent with these kind of theoretical claims that people make, well, that's a very important fact, and it serves as kind of a clue, you know, for thinking through the theoretical issue in a more, you know, more profound way. Right? And in this case, you say, well, what's wrong with that theoretical argument? It forces you to consider the question, what's wrong with these things that Waltz and Mearsheimer said? And I referred to this last time, but I just want to again emphasize the importance of it. You know, the Waltz argument is that no state intends to participate in the formation of a structure by which it and others will be constrained. It just says that flat. You say, well, here you have these states participating in the formation of a structure by which they and the other states will be constrained. Why would they want to do it? Why would we want to take part in the creation of a structure which would constrain our policies? Why would we want to straitjacket ourselves? Right? And the answer is, because everyone else is going to be doing it. Right? Everyone else is going to also be constrained by the same system. And that's a huge benefit for us. If our goal is security, then it's of enormous importance to us that the policies of the other major powers in the system would be constrained, would be constrained as well. It's of enormous importance of us that we're not threatened by other countries because they're also constrained by the same system. It's a good deal. It's something we would want to do. And I should just say in passing that whole way of looking at things is in fact fortified by a somewhat different body of thought that draws on some important work that was done in the last 20 or 30 years in cognitive psychology, of all places. I don't know if any of you have heard of Tversky and Kahneman. They won Nobel Prizes for this work and so on. This is based on the idea that people are less inclined to take risks to ensure gains for themselves, or not to ensure gains, the risks of achieving gains, than they are to avoid losses. That's what we call loss aversion. You know, the notion is you'd rather kind of keep what you have than run a 10% chance of gaining 10 times as much, that sort of thing. Right. And the basic argument here is that the fear of loss is just much more powerful than the hope of gain. That fear is a more powerful emotion than greed. Well, if you could have a system that solves that problem, that enables you to keep those fears under control, well, abandoning your greedy goals would be a good good point, right? You know, the social contract and so on. One of the distinctive features about that whole body of thought, those 18th century theorists, is that they were claiming that the states of Europe, not of the whole world, of Europe, formed a society, a kind of republic, they say, right? So they were projecting the structure that you find inside a state to Europe as a whole. You know, as a matter of fact, that type of thinking lies at the heart of one of the schools of international relations thought in our own day, the so-called English school, Hedley Bull, Martin White. I don't know if you've heard of any of these people, but they placed the notion of international society, the idea that the society of states is like a kind of primitive society, at the heart of all their theorizing. Okay. So this is an episode that helps us rethink some of these issues, these claims that international relations theorists have made. Okay? So you have this system. System, you can look at it both in terms of its structure, but also in terms of its spirit. How you could note the fact that Prussia was in effect, the center of gravity of Prussia was moved to the west, so that Prussian power would serve as more of a counterweight to France, if France thought in terms of expansion into what's now Belgium, for example, French-speaking lowlands. United Netherlands with Belgium and Holland coming together as a kind of mid-ranking power, kind of backed up by Prussian power, again, a source of containment for France, and then the same sort of thing in the south with a strengthened Piedmontese state, Kingdom of Sardinia was called, backed up by Austrian power, with Italy as kind of an Austrian sphere of influence. So there would be these constraints on France, but France would not be turned into a cipher. France would still be a major power. France would be treated gently so that the French would accept the legitimacy of the system, and French power would be an important part of the European equilibrium, serving in particular as part of a system that could serve as a restraint against any possible Russian ambitions, Russian expansion. So you have those structures in play. The German Confederation, Austria and Prussia, the two leading German states, trying to get along with each other, running Germany on a kind of a joint basis. German Confederation strong as a kind of defensive unit, but incapable of not tightly organized enough for it to be used for offensive military purposes. It doesn't threaten people. A system where Austrian power is pivotal. Austria is not the strongest country in Europe by any means, but Austria, for internal reasons, is wedded to the status quo, and so Austrian policy is bound to favor the status quo, and these other countries like Britain that are interested in the maintenance of the status quo, therefore support Austria and so on. You have all of these structural elements but they are by no means the whole story of the Vienna system, because it's the spirit of it that's perhaps even more important, in the sense that instead of being at each other's throats, we've got to try and work together. We've got to keep our rivalries under control, because once we start falling apart, you know, there would be very, very serious consequences. I mean, this is a system. One final point about it before I kind of move on is that this notion of how to create a stable international order is based squarely on the concept of power, balance of power, on equilibrium of power, on these great nations relating to each other as great powers who have a certain stake in this great power political system, who are trying to achieve an equilibrium of power. And moral considerations take a back seat to that. This is, I'll read you something. This is from Cassirer. And, you know, like readings this week, you have a couple of these primary sources, the Cassirer letter to Rose, his ambassador in Berlin, and then the Cassirer state paper. In a sense, those kinds of things are the most important part of the course, because you can actually see these people as real human beings who are trying to grapple with very serious political problems. You could kind of connect with them over the centuries, almost two centuries earlier. But anyway, this Cassirer was very explicit that in conducting policy, you had to base your policy on these power political considerations, and not on moral considerations like the spread of democracy, the spread of freedom, anything like that. And he's talking to one of his ambassadors about this whole notion that the aim of British policy should be to spread liberty and so on. And he says, "I cannot bring myself to wish that the too extensive experiment in the science of government, already in operation throughout Europe, should be at once augmented by similar creations in Italy. It is impossible not to perceive a great moral change coming on in Europe," you know, the rise of liberalism, rise of freedom, "and the principles of freedom are in full operation. The danger is that the transition may be too sudden to make the world better or happier." You know, you can't put a lid on this great movement. You're a little worried about it. This is Britain, the premier liberal power in Europe. You're worried about it kind of getting out of hand, going too far. Well, you saw the French Revolution. And also in that letter that Cassirer sent to Rose, you see his discomfort with the fact that the Prussian government seems to have riding the tiger of these new nationalistic movements, you know, based on the notion of self-determination of peoples. Cassirer is very uncomfortable with that. If you want to kind of get some clues into that way of thinking, read that Name Your article that I put on the website as one of the recommended readings for this week. Because for Namier, there's this, he's criticizing the notion that liberty and democracy go hand in hand. We all take that for granted. But these kind of conservative statesmen, they didn't think that that was the case. They distrusted democracy. They distrusted what would happen if the untutored masses really took control of the state. They just didn't know how to manage things. And there was Namier insists on the difference between kind of constitutional development within the existing state framework that provides the basis for liberty, because you can only have liberty with that sort of order, and these democratic movements based on self-determination, based on the nation as a linguistic group or a racial group or something like that. that could easily lead to trouble. These conservative statesmen thought in those terms. These statesmen thought in terms of power, not in terms of liberal ideology. Obviously, the Russian Tsar and Metternich, conservative statesmen in continental Europe, were not inclined to think in those terms at all. They were very much worried about the threat of revolution, which was why Woodrow Wilson hated the Congress of Vienna so much. Which is why Woodrow Wilson said at the end of the First World War that we're not going to do what was done after the Napoleonic Wars, the last great, international conflict. That we're going to put policy, that we're going to put build an international order based on moral principle, based on democracy, based on self-determination, and so on. Right? And one of the great questions that you have to grapple with when you study these things is you look at what happened after 1815, the kind of system that was created in Vienna, and you look at how it worked, and then you compare that with how things worked after 1919, after the First World War ended, and Wilson and his colleagues worked out a peace settlement, and you try and understand whether the disasters of the post-1919 period as compared with the relative successes of the post-1815 period had anything to do with that fundamental difference in approach, a fundamental difference about how foreign policy should be conducted, whether it should be conducted on the basis of moral principle or whether it should be conducted primarily on the basis of power political considerations, where moral considerations are pushed to the side. Right? That's one of the great issues, one of the central issues in the study of international politics. And you should try, as you study these things, to kind of reach some sort of conclusion. Okay. So how did it work? That's the main thing that we're going to be concerned with today. How did the Vienna system work in the period after 1815? And I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but this is going to be a boring lecture today. Why? because not much happened. Well, we'll talk about the various things that happened, and you'll find it hard to be very interested in these things because they're not all that important. It's not like core national interests are at stake, or it's not like there was a real threat of general European war or anything like that. It's boring. It's boring because not much was happening. But often, when you study international politics, or study things in general, what doesn't happen can be of absolutely fundamental importance. And you'll know the story about Sherlock Holmes and the dog in the night? The significant episode of the dog in the night, very famous story. Because Dr. Watson says to Sherlock Holmes, but the dog did nothing in the night. And Sherlock Holmes says, that was the significant episode. That was what was significant, that the dog should have barked, and there was no barking. All right? When you study these things, often it's what doesn't happen that's of primary importance. It's what doesn't happen, the fact that there are no really serious crises in this period, and that these European countries were able to work things out. That's the hallmark of a stable system. In a sense, peace is as important as war when you're studying international politics. The stability of the system is a measure of how well the arrangements worked out at Vienna were functioning. Right? And they're functioning, as we'll see, rather well. Okay? I should say also that you, this is one of the reasons why it's important to approach these issues with a theoretical framework in mind. It's why it's important to always keep these general theoretical questions in mind, because it's only then that the significance of such things becomes apparent. It's only then you can see why it's important to observe that not much happened in this period. It wasn't as though there were no political conflicts. In a sense, Europe in the first half of the 19th century had the same basic structure as Europe in the second half of the 19th century. It was still a Europe of five great powers, no single one of which was able to totally dominate Europe, or in fact, even aspire to that kind of domination. I should say that's an important point. There's a famous book that deals with the diplomacy of the 19th century by the British historian A.J.P. Taylor called The Struggle for Mastery in Europe. And that title alone, you know, people like Mearsheimer and Waltz would find that approach very congenial, because their notion is that countries are struggling for mastery, not just for security. The idea is that the way to achieve security is by becoming as strong as possible, and ideally by becoming the hegemon, the dominant power in your region, so strong no one else can challenge you, right? And so they would say, yeah, of course, European politics is a struggle for mastery. But there wasn't a single time, of course, in the 19th century when any of these powers could aspire to anything like that. No single European power, even Germany at the very end, was strong enough for that sort of thing. Right? They all knew that their power was constrained by the possibility of a coalition of all the other powers in Europe. They couldn't stand up to a coalition of all the other powers. So no one country could really aspire to hegemony. Doesn't mean that there was no international political life, because all these countries have different interests. And when interests differ, sometimes you get conflicts. And when you get conflicts, there's always the question of, well, how are they going to be resolved? Right? Yeah, conflicts. In this period that we're going to be talking about, above all, over the southern flank of Europe, the Iberian Peninsula, the Italian Peninsula, and the Balkan Peninsula, right? Spain, Italy, Ottoman Empire, Turkey. And of these three areas, Turkey was by far the most important. I mean, you all know the background of this. Turkish power had been expanding into Europe, even into the 17th century. In the mid-17th century, Turkish army stood outside the gates of Vienna, in the very heart of Europe. Right? So that was the high point. And gradually, Turkish power declined, and the Turks were pushed back, especially by Russia in the north, to the point where in 1776 the Russians were able to seize the Crimea, which is this peninsula here, going into the Black Sea from Turkey. And you'll see that if you're interested in this stuff, take a look at the maps that were posted in the website that I indicated in the syllabus. And Turkey is never quite a European power, because it's a Muslim power. And it rules over all of these Christian populations in southeastern Europe. And with the spread of the ideas of the French Revolution toward the east, notions of self-determination and so on, and also the sense of Europe is getting of itself as the most powerful region in the world, the Turkish power in relative decline in comparison with Europe. The question obviously presented itself of what the future of the Ottoman Empire is going to be. And there were important power political interests at stake here. Russia, which neighbored the Ottoman Empire, was obviously concerned with the with all of these issues for a whole variety of reasons, part power political, part other kinds of issues. Russia was concerned with the fate of her fellow Slavs under Ottoman control, the co-religionists, most of them, members of the Orthodox Church. Russia was also concerned with getting control over the Turkish Straits, if possible, or certainly preventing foreign powers from getting control over the Turkish Straits. Austria was worried about expansion of Russian power into that area, because if Russian power started moving down into the Balkans, and surrounding Austria, then that would exercise a certain effect on the Slavic populations within the Austrian monarchy. About half the population of the Austrian monarchy were Slavs, and Austria's security would be put at risk. Right? Britain and France were concerned about the expansion of Russian power as well. Prussia didn't care very much, but Prussia was the weakest of the five European powers. And this was a serious issue. Similarly, there the fate of Spain and Italy kind of mattered to the great powers. Why did it matter? In large part for ideological reasons. Because the whole notion of the Vienna system was that the territorial status quo, the existing political order, was sacrosanct, and you couldn't, a lot of people felt you couldn't tolerate revolution. You had to support the existing state structure. Those three issues relating to the southern interior of Europe dominated great power politics in the 1820s. You had a revolution in Spain in the year 1820. What was the revolution about? The restored ruler of Spain, King Ferdinand, wanted to suppress the constitutional order that he had promised to support. And in fact, he wanted also to send Spanish troops to reassert Spanish control over their empire in the Americas. Americas had taken advantage of Napoleonic wars and Spain's weakness during that period to throw off the Spanish yoke and assert their independence. The independence, which was supported by the British and by the very, you all know about the Monroe Doctrine of 1823, it was all part of this episode here. So these army officers didn't want to be shipped off to the Americas, and they rose up against Ferdinand, and there was this Spain. And the Tsar wanted to suppress the revolution in Spain. And the Austrians didn't like this idea because it meant that Russian armies would be marching all over Europe. They didn't like the notion of Russia as anything like a guarantor of the European order, as kind of the policeman of Europe. So what happened? The British opposed the Russian aspirations. Again, they didn't like this whole notion of a very rigid political structure. And yet the threat of Russian intervention in Spain led Castlereagh to put down his thoughts about the whole issue of intervention. When is it permissible? What should basic attitude of a country like Britain be toward all of this? And he laid out his thoughts in a very important document, that state paper of his, that's part of the reading for this week. The collection that Xerox was taken from referred to this as the foundation of British policy in the 19th century. Important document, because again, you get to see his thinking. I'll just read you some of the key passages here. It deals with this whole issue of what can you hope to accomplish by an intervention, even if you did it? Is it worth it? What could it possibly achieve? He says, what could the Allied powers look to effect by their arms if the supposition of an armed interference in the internal affairs of another state could be admitted? Perhaps as little, because in supposing them finally triumphant, we have the problem still to solve how the country in which such interference had been successful was to provide for its self-government after the Allied armies shall have been withdrawn, without soon becoming an equal source of danger to the tranquility of neighboring states. In other words, the intervention, it could very easily be just futile. But when we consider how much danger may arise to the internal safety of the rest of Europe by the absence of those armies, which must be withdrawn to overrun the country in which the supposed interference is to take place, what may be the danger of these armies being contaminated, what may be the encumbrances to be added by such renewed exertions to the already overwhelming weight of the debts of the different states, what the local irritation which must be occasioned by pouring forth such immense armies, pressing severely as they must do upon the resources of countries already agitated and inflamed, no rational statesman surely would found his prospects of security on such a calculation. He would rather be of opinion that the only necessity which could in wisdom justify such an attempt is that which, temperately considered, appears to leave to Europe no other option than that of either going to meet that danger which they cannot avoid, or having it poured in the full tide of military invasion upon their own states. This is similar to the Bush strategy of preemption. Remember, this whole notion that you can't wait till the problem gets totally out of hand. You have to, intervene militarily before it's too late. The actual existence of such a danger may indeed be inferred from many circumstances short of the visible preparations for attack. But it is submitted that on this basis, the conclusion should always be examined. See, what's important about this? He's basically saying, you don't intervene for ideological reasons. You don't intervene because you have a commitment to keep these legitimate monarchs on their thrones as a kind of end in itself. You intervene for power political reasons. You intervene only when your basic power political interests are at stake. Right? And he goes on to say that there's one case only that he can imagine which would warrant a British intervention of that sort. And that's the danger of France taking over Belgium and having, Belgium was not a country at this point, but, the French-speaking areas of the Low Countries. And having those areas just, melted into the general structure of French power. Right? But he says, you got to think of the problem in power political terms. Okay? And I said, why is this important, this emphasis on power politics? How does it conduce to a stable system? Because power politics is a common language. All these states have different ideologies. Tsarist Russia is very different from liberal England. Right? But if you want them to be able to talk to each other and hammer out a common policy, they have to talk the same language, which is the language of power and interest, not the language of ideology. Right? That's you don't have enough power to be able to use it very freely in support of any of every ideological whim that you have. Power is a scarce commodity. And because it's scarce, it's a resource that you have to husband. You have to use it sparingly. Only when your core national interests are at stake. Only when there's a real threat to your security. You can't use it for ideological purposes, right? You can see why Woodrow Wilson would hate this sort of thing. Okay. And so they work something out. Instead of Russian armies marching across Europe, the powers agree that France would be charged with intervening in Spain, but would receive a European mandate for doing so, and that there would be very strict limits on the nature of the French intervention and on the duration of the French intervention. And France, during this period, has an interest in playing the Concert of Europe game, an interest in working with the other powers and accepting those conditions. France, part of it has to do with the nature of the French political system, the Restoration, the Bourbon dynasty that had ruled France before 1789, before the French Revolution, was brought back into power after the fall of Napoleon. And yet there are a lot of people in France that were not too thrilled with the Bourbon regime. You're interested in these things. I don't know how many of you read Stendhal's great novel, The Red and the Black. It just captures the essence of French society in that period just beautifully. It's actually my favorite novel from the 19th century. But the Bourbons' grip on France is not all that secure, right? They don't have enough control over their own country to risk playing the lone cavalier and pursuing a totally independent policy that challenges all of you. Same sort of thing in Italy. There's another revolution in Naples, in what's called the Kingdom of Two Sicilies, this whole area at the very southernmost part of the Italian peninsula. And again, now it's a question of intervention against the revolutionaries there. The Austrians want to intervene. Castlereagh basically gives them the green light. Which points to another important aspect of the system. Called spheres of influence. Countries, these major powers, part of the way they get along with each other is that they recognize that each of them has special rights in areas that are fundamental to their security. So Britain and France have much more of an interest in what goes on in the Iberian Peninsula, for example, than Russia does. So Britain and France should basically call the shots about what happens in terms of intervention in Spain or in Portugal. Austria has fundamental interest in Italy. So the other powers defer to Austria about Italy. But this is why the whole business with Southeastern Europe is so important, because this is not a Russian sphere of interest the same way that Spain was an Anglo-French sphere of interest. The Russians have important interests in Turkey. So do the other powers. Britain, France, and especially Austria. And so you don't have a simple spheres of influence answer to the question of what to do. You have a revolution, or an uprising, really, breaking out in Greece, also in the 1820s, and the whole question is what to do about it. A lot of people in Britain, want to intervene on the cause of the Greeks, cause of Greek democracy. They have a very romantic view of the Greeks. Think of Lord Byron, for example, going over to Greece. Castlereagh doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to kind of give vent to those principles if the effect would be to kind of tear down the existing structure. And he's viciously attacked for that within the British Parliament. This is the, one of the things that leads to Castlereagh's suicide in 1822. What to do about Greece? Allow the kind of Turks to simply massacre off the Greeks as a way of, you know, putting down the Greek insurrection? Once again, the powers try to work together. They have different interests, but they draw in their horns and they try and work together, try and work out some sort of solution that's acceptable for the Greeks. Ultimately, part of Greece is given its independence from Turkey. Russia doesn't want to oppose the other major powers in Europe. And on the other hand, Russian feelings about all these issues are kind of divided. You want to kind of keep Turkey intact as kind of this buffer area, shielding Russia from the pressures of the other powers. Or do you want to penetrate into Turkey and absorb Turkey into the Russian sphere? Well, that latter course of action is viewed as too dangerous. No one says you could be totally passive and turn a blind eye to what's going on there. But the basic assumption was that you should try and work these things out together as a bloc. And they do. These problems are kind of second-order problems, third-order problems. They're managed. Right? No really serious crisis among the major European states happens during this. That's the quality of international political life in the first half of the century, or the period 1815 to 1848. Why is 1848 such a sharp dividing point? Because in 1848 there's a series of revolutions that breaks out in continental Europe. Right? Successful in France, at least for a time. Ushering in the Second Republic, and then the Second Republic is replaced by the Second Empire after Louis Napoleon, the nephew of the famous Emperor Napoleon, has a coup d'etat. But also in Central Europe, there's an attempted German unity in Frankfurt, there's revolutionary stirrings in the Austrian Empire, especially in Hungary, the Russians have to intervene. Rulers of Austria, revolutionary disturbances in Italy as well. And the revolutions of 1848 usher in some very fundamental political changes that ultimately bring about a rather different kind of political system in Europe. So we'll see. Bismarck is very different from Mary. So once again, you see the effect of what goes on internally in shaping the structure of international politics. So, yeah? Yeah, that's, a lot of them were. A lot of them were. Metternich remained in power until 1848. He was pretty much the only one. But people did have this, you know, the sense of, you know, what a massive earthquake the French Revolution had been and how it led to the whole phenomenon of Napoleon and the something that threatened everything. It threatened the independence of these states, plus it threatened the kind of social order that these people were attached to. So, yeah, so that was an important reason, fear of revolution, desire to make sure that what you would experience from 1789 to 1815 was never repeated again. Right? But anyway, so next time we'll begin with 1848 and talk about the new system that came into being then.